Danny, Danny Schechter,
known as the news dissector.
You know, I joined the media, preserving democracy, do something about the problems of the world. I'm the author, I'm the producer.
Hey, hello everybody, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
Issues, the history of the world.
Hey, hello, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
That's me, that's what I think, Demands for justice, losing their hope, working class solidarity, co-opted the media. Issues. That's me, that's what I think. Danny Schechter, your news dissector. What do you think?
I'm here today on the News Dissector Radio Hour with Polar Levine. He's back in action in the studio today. Say hi.
Hello.
That's enough. And now we're about to bring you a really important conversation, not so much because we're having it, but because the guest that is going to be joining us, Paul Craig Roberts, is a former assistant Treasury Secretary of the United States under the Reagan administration, yet has emerged as a critical voice on our economy. Who's able to not only look at things in a contrarian way, but also in a realistic way, where, you know, we've been reading about how the economy is bouncing back, everything is in recovery mode, housing market is going up, the new Fed chairman, Ms. Yellen, is saying, oh, things are going to get better, and yet others are saying, wait a minute, we're on the edge of a collapse in our country. And that's what I want to explore with Paul Craig Roberts, who's standing by on the phone. But first, Paul, because our show, we like to start off with a little musical signature. Here's a little song about the economy that you might enjoy.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank.
Hi, Paul. That's the anthem of a film I made called In Debt We Trust, and we play it here on the radio show from time to time, and I'm really pleased that you could find some time to be with us today, because I know you're very busy, and certainly, you know, a sense of the output of all the pieces that you're writing and distributing through, I think, Creators Syndicate. You have quite a large audience nationwide, worldwide perhaps, who find in what you're writing a certain credibility, in part because you weren't always, you know, on this one, you know, critical side of the spectrum. Perhaps you can start off today by telling us a little bit about your background and how you began to, you know, think anew, if you did.
Oh, well, I was educated at Georgia Tech, University of Virginia, University of California, Berkeley, and Oxford University. Studied with Nobel laureates in economics, have a PhD, held many university appointments, was associate editor to the Wall Street Journal. I was in the congressional staff, was assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury, in charge of domestic economic policy. I've also had a career as a journalist with Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Scripps Howard News Service. I have my own website. It's paulcraigroberts.org. The columns are picked up, carried in translation all over the world. Just and I've had a lot of business experience. I've been president of a water company, of a consulting firm. I've been advisor to the major financial institutions in the United States.
Well, with that background...
And just have paid attention and have a lot of experience. I've seen a lot, and I don't represent any interest group, and so I don't have to put a gloss on anything in order to keep my position or earn my income. I can afford to call it as I see it.
What do you think it is that leads so many financial journalists to be sort of stenographers of power? They don't often bring a critical perspective. In my film, I made a second film on the economy called Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and I looked at the role of the media. I'm a media critic as well as a journalist and writer and author, and found that at the same time that the economy was, you know, teetering on the edge of what became the 2007 and then 2008 bubble bursting, there was a sort of a litany in the media that was saying everything is good, everything is great, you know, we're doing well. You know, there was a way in which the media seemed to be, you know, a promotional arm of the banks and the people who had an interest in telling us how great everything was.
Well, the American media has never been very good, but it essentially ceased to exist when the Clinton administration allowed five mega firms to buy it all up and concentrate it. And that destroyed its diversity and its independence. And when you have that type of concentration, the value of the mega firms is the federal broadcast licenses. And so if journalists in your mega media empire annoy the government, your broadcast licenses might not be renewed, and so the entire multi-billion dollar value of your company would disappear.
I mean,
and also, these media firms are no longer run by journalists. They're run by corporate advertising executives.
You know, at
they don't want to upset the corporations that advertise, and so it's worse, much worse than it used to be because of the concentration. Now, any sort of journalist, whether he's covering the White House or covering a presidential campaign or covering the financial sector, they need access. If they don't have access, they're not useful to their editors or to their employer. And so if they make too many waves and too much trouble for the people or the organizations they're covering, they lose access and that loses their career.
Could that be because, in some respects, the beats, so-called beats that journalists are assigned in terms of what they're going to cover, require for them to get, quote, you know, insider information, access, and to be friendly with their sources so that they can't bring a more critical perspective and hope to keep their jobs? And it seems as if
that's what I said, right?
Yeah, okay.
And, of course, it happens to suppose you are have the crime beat. You simply become a mouthpiece for the prosecutor. You don't examine his cases. You just give his side of the story. And generally, the defendant's convicted in the media and has to make a plea bargain because he knows he can't go to trial. Everybody already thinks he's guilty.
But, you know, this is not just...
So this is a general problem. It's gotten worse. And... with the concentration, so.
But it's not just about journalism not doing its job. This makes democracy almost unable to function in the sense that people are not aware of a lot of what's going on, don't know how to become aware, don't ask questions themselves, and in the end are reacting to what they're being told, or this kind of form of, petty debate that takes place, phony debate, I would say, you know, between on a partisan basis, between, various pundits who specialize in being louder and more obnoxious than the next guy.
Yeah, the Americans live in the matrix. And what they think, or what most of them think, is programmed into them. And the media is a ministry of propaganda now, for the government as well.
I mean, is it possible that they sort of believe their own hype? You know, I mean, I'm reading today in the New York Times front page here about how the president had been disposed to be critical of too much spying. He had issued warnings about it when he was still in the Senate. But then when he got into office, he began to react, waking up every day, it says here, to a myriad of threat warnings in his daily intelligence briefings. And as a consequence, they defined, their narrative defined not only what he knew, but in a sense, how he should react.
Well, it takes a very knowledgeable person, a very confident and strong person to stand up to special interests. And of course, the military security complex is a powerful special interest. It was 50 or more years ago that President Dwight Eisenhower warned the country about the military industrial complex, as it was known then. Of course, we don't have much industry anymore, but it's now known as the military security complex. This is an extremely powerful group. They've got plenty of money to provide campaign contributions, to purchase voices, studies from think tanks. They can be a formidable opponent, and so a president is faced with that, just as he's faced with the Israel lobby, he's faced with the Wall Street lobby.
So
the agribusiness lobby, the
but you know,
mining, and
I mean, how many people tomorrow, when the president gives his big speech at the Justice Department, not at the offices of the Civil Liberties Union, you know, and basically defends, as the New York Times tells us he will, government spying, even as he, quote, adjusts it, his speech, to address a wave of public concern over civil liberties. So we're being told straight out here he is going to be defending all of this, although he might introduce some, quote, reforms to make us feel better about it. And at the same time, when the commentary is done of this, I think very few people will look at the financial interests there. Am I right? I mean, do you expect an analysis of Booz Hamilton? I guess we've lost you, Paul. We're going to try to get you back. I'm sorry. The man is a brilliant an analyst.
Yeah. You know, one thing also that came to mind, you know, about the whole thing about the media consolidation and the lack of actual journalism these days is that, when you have a society that's the top alpha dog in the world, that affluence gets you real used to comfort and real used to entertainment, you know, as though it's an entitlement, and the media companies, and they got that. And
so let's say, Paul, if you were covering this speech tomorrow, knowing now today what he's going to be saying, according to all this leaking that's gone on, probably an exercise in reassuring the intelligence agencies that he's not going to, you know, take too many of their toys away. You know, what would you point to, or point us to, in terms of the questions we should be asking?
Well, there's the spying is strictly unconstitutional. Strictly unconstitutional. There's no ifs or buts about it. And so what you see happening is the Constitution being overturned. Now, that's an act of treason. So the president and the NSA and all the rest of them, they are treasonous. They are engaging in treason. They are not keeping their oath to defend the Constitution against enemies, domestic and foreign. They are the enemy of the Constitution. That's obvious. It's not even subject to debate. There's another thing that's so important is there's no need for the spying. You're not going to learn anything about Al-Qaeda by monitoring the email and online purchases and knowing what sites every American visits online. This is not going to tell you anything.
You don't think that's going to disrupt terrorist plots? At least that's what we're being told.
And furthermore, there's not any terrorism. It's a hoax.
Okay, explain that.
There have been no terrorist attacks in what now, 12 years. What was 9-11 was 2001. So if you, assuming you believe the government's account of that, that this was an actual terrorist account, attack that outsmarted all 16 American intelligence agencies, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the National Security Council, NORAD, air traffic control, that a few Arabs were smarter than the entire national security state and brought it to its knees. If you believe that, what other terrorist event has occurred?
Well, you know, we have David Plouffe here in the New York Times telling us, he says, you know, when you get the package every morning, it puts steel in your spine. There are people out there every day who are plotting. And the notion that we would put down a tool that would protect people here in America
is hard to fathom.
This is BS.
That is totally BS. There's no evidence of any plots. That's why the FBI has to orchestrate fake plots. We now have 150 fake plots. They go out, they find some deranged person or persons, devise a plot, they talk these people into it, usually with a promise of money or heroics, and then they arrest them and they agree. But these are not plots. No one was ever in any danger, and the announcement is always the public was never in any danger. The FBI was in firm control.
Wouldn't you say
if you have to manufacture the plots, it means there's not any real ones?
Wouldn't you say that it's the instinct of every government in power, or every circle of power.
No, wait.
To want information about every citizen under its control, going back to the beginning of human history, the those in power would have dreamed about having access to everybody's goings on and what they think. And I totally agree with you. I think it has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. They're taking advantage of just something that's instinctive,
I don't think that governments do have that desire because no other government is doing it. Only the United States.
Yeah, true enough.
Only the so-called great democracy, true. The indispensable country, the exceptional people, only here.
Well, there's China.
The rest of the world was shocked out of their mind.
Yeah, but nobody seems to be doing it at this scale.
And then let's come to the rest of this.
They can't.
Only, of all the countries in the world, it is only the President of the United States that says he has the power to murder his own citizens without due process of law. No other leader of any country on earth makes this claim.
Well, they say
the President of the United States is also
the
only leader on earth who claims the right to throw citizens into a dungeon for the rest of their life without due process of law.
I saw a great quote today. You know, Martin Luther King had a dream, and Barack Obama has a drone. This is a kind of false dependence on technology, obviously, and it shows not only paranoia but also the incredible insecurity of the little world in which these people inhabit. Now, in that world, and I want to get to this because this is something you've been studying.
I think it doesn't show insecurity. I think what it shows is an agenda for hegemony.
Okay.
Not only over the world but over its own population. So what we have had happen in the 21st century from Bush and Obama both, is to make the executive branch of the government unaccountable to law. In fact, it's now a Caesar. It's not accountable to law. It can torture in violation of U.S. and international law. It can spy on citizens in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, under which each act of spying carries a five-year prison sentence. So Bush and Obama have are responsible enough spying to be locked up for a trillion years each.
You know, Paul.
So, and nothing happens. There's no accountability to the government. So this is unique.
Well, one of the things,
not only in our history, but in world history.
One of the things that they seem to be afraid of, you know, is that in fact the economy is going to collapse and the people are going to revolt and are already revolting. And so, you know, we now have a Homeland Security agency, whatever, was just ordered a zillion bullets. There seems to be two senses of economy. What they tell us, which is that things are looking up, but what they tell each other is that things are looking really bad. And you've been talking about a collapse of our system, which goes even beyond that. How did you get to that view?
Well, the system's collapsed across the board. It's already collapsed in terms of law being a shield of the people. It's now a weapon in the hands of government. The minute the government is not accountable to law, you have tyranny. And so we already have tyranny because the government is not accountable to its own laws. Now, on the economic front, the collapse began with the offshoring of middle-class jobs. We've had now 15 years of heavy movement of middle-class incomes offshore to other lands. And this has collapsed the ladders of upward mobility inside the United States. Manufacturing jobs sent offshore, the tradable professional service jobs such as software engineers, information technology, research, design, the kinds of jobs that university graduates used to look forward to, they are offshore. So there's no growth and has been no growth in real consumer income for years. And if there's no growth in income, there's nothing to drive the economy. And so the Federal Reserve, with Alan Greenspan, said, okay, we will substitute a credit expansion. We will use the expansion of consumer debt to take the place of the missing growth in consumer income. And so they did. And we saw the effect of that was the real estate bubble and the various speculative, fraudulent real estate derivatives that the banking system created, and then the crash. And the consequence of the crash was, one, the banks are no longer subject to market discipline. They're wards of the government. The Federal Reserve has a policy of quantitative easing. It creates $1,000 billion a year to support the balance sheets of the banks and to finance the federal deficit that resulted from the financial collapse. So this then puts pressure on the dollar. The whole world holds tremendous amounts of dollars and dollar-denominated assets because the United States currency has been the world reserve currency since the end of World War II. And so everybody's sitting there, looking at these dollars that they hold, and say, look, they're creating $1,000 billion a year. There's no demand for those. What's happening to the value of the ones that we hold? And so the gold price took off. And so the Fed said, oh, gosh, this will undo the whole thing. If the dollar keeps falling in terms of gold, it'll soon start falling in terms of other currencies. We've got to manipulate the gold price. So they started selling naked shorts on the COMEX in New York to drive down the gold price. So all the markets are manipulated. The bond market, the stock market are due entirely to the liquidity the Fed is pouring into the banking system. There's no underlying economy to support the highest stock market of all time.
Do you think this can change under Yellen, or is that a pipe dream?
Of course not.
A pipe dream, a kind of who's going to put the genie back in the bottle.
The Federal Reserve serves the banks.
Right. Which a lot of people don't realize that the Federal Reserve is actually run by the banks.
People don't realize very much.
Well, yes and no, Paul. I mean, I think the fact that you have such an audience for your work and the provocative articles and analysis that you've been pumping out there has built an audience and a lot of people who are concerned about it. And I think that's...
I know, but it's not something like a third of the population or anything like that.
All right, well, there's a way to go, okay? Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
I feel the same way, you know.
It takes a lot of awareness on the part of the public in order that people who know what to do can lead. So the reason we don't have any leaders is the people are just too unaware and ignorant to understand the problems and to recognize a leader. So this makes it very difficult for leaders to rise up because the public hasn't the knowledge or the wits to recognize the leader.
Well, you know, it's not too cheerful. Do you have any New Year's resolutions to share with us? I'm joking. No, we're trying to.
No, I don't.
I'm trying to because you know,
I think
it seems pretty bleak.
I think what's going to correct the situation, if anything does, will be the collapse of the dollar under the pressure of all the money printing. The Chinese announced a couple of weeks ago that they weren't going to accumulate any more dollars. We see the largest countries, Brazil, India, China, Russia, South Africa, creating their own financial system, which will dispense with the use of the dollar.
It's BRICS. The BRICS.
The BRICS. So the demand for the dollar currency markets will fall. This has to affect its price. The Fed can support it for a while and with various manipulations, but not indefinitely. And also the U.S., is losing its clout internationally. We saw that with Syria. Obama thought he could tell the same kind of lies that Bush taught about Iraq and get away with it, and the world pulled him up short.
Also, what he wanted
he
to do.
So this is a new development. It shows an erosion in American credibility and authority and clout, and I think this will spread. I think the world's tired of the bully America. They're tired of the financial hedge enemy, the bullying, of all the phone calls they get. If you don't do it, we say we're going to bomb you into the Stone Age. That doesn't work anymore. And the Russians and Chinese are not going to put up with it. And I think Europe is beginning to see that Washington has positioned them in such a way that they would be targets of Russian nuclear missiles because of their support for NATO and American aggressiveness. So I think at some point Germany will fall away and say this isn't in our interest. We don't want to be positioned such that we're targeted by the Russians because of you and your insane drive for hedge enemy. So I think these are the changes that will come. And the power of the country will decline. And the currency will lose its world reserve role. And there'll be so many problems for the leaders to have to deal with that they'll have to realize they can't, that this national security state is not supportable, and there's no need for it. So I think if there's any change, that's the way it will happen.
Well, of course, you know that the whole scenario that you just laid out and the whole, you know, very calmly expressed narrative is, you know, 360 degrees or more away from what we're told every single night and every single day in our media system. So,
well, that's what the media's for. It's a propaganda ministry.
And so,
don't ever expect the media to tell you anything that's correct. Well, they have to tell you what Washington wants you to hear, what the advertisers want you to hear, the corporations. The best way to get in trouble in the media is to be a truth teller.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. I'm glad.
Yeah, but you're not. You know, you're
obviously
independent of that.
Obviously, but yeah. You know, that's the instincts that we have, and I think that's the instinct that you had. I want to thank you so much. I promised that I'd only keep you a half hour because you're a busy man. But thank you so much for coming on with us today and sharing what you were able to share in the last half hour here on News Dissector Radio. It meant a lot for me. That's why I was so persistent in trying to nail you down on a time. And I'm thankful that you agreed to come. So I hope we'll keep
it. I appreciate that you shared your audience with me.
Yeah, I hope we can really do it.
Yeah. I appreciate what you're trying to do. I think that's important. And the more, the better.
I hope we can do it again. We're going to leave on this particular song about your banks, the banks that you are so enthralled by, quote unquote. That's a joke. Okay.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that Phil Everly, one of the Everly brothers, died. I think it was last week, and it was a moving thing for me because I mean the Everly brothers was one of the most influential bands in pop music. The sibling vocal high harmony style has been tried to be duplicated for decades ever since. I say bye-bye, love.
Question I keep asking, when will I be done? But I never get any answers. But you know, I think it's important for us to show on this program that information and culture can coexist, cohabit on the same program in a way that often puts us in the mood and state of mind to think about things in a different way. And one of the things I saw recently that was sort of funny, I don't know if you saw this, but Bruce Springsteen version of Born to Run that was done on whose show?
The Jimmy Fallon.
Jimmy Fallon's show is hysterical. Takeoff on the traffic jam in New Jersey. I don't have that.
Well, I think it was specifically a slap in the face to Chris Christie because, you know, it was known that Chris Christie idolized Bruce Springsteen,
right.
And Obama, when they got together over Sandy, made a special effort to bring the two of them together. Apparently, it was a major moment for Christie, and to have his idol whack him on TV.
But, you know, Chris Hedges, another Chris, has written about this this past week, and talked about, you know, the economic ties that Christie has to various Wall Street firms and Republican funders and some Democratic funders as well, who are grooming him to run for president. He's tied into an extremely reactionary nexus of power, which very rarely gets discussed. Most of what, you know, we hear about is his weight, and occasionally the fact that he's not in the Tea Party, so therefore somehow he represents good values, when in fact there's a lot of criticism of Christie. And this incident of, you know, having a traffic jam in Fort Lee, New Jersey, showed the contempt for the public in a way. that we haven't really seen before. And I think the media jumped all over it. It wasn't a major issue in my mind, but it was major enough to have questions raised about Christie.
Well, I think it is a major issue when you have the governor of the bedroom community of a serious city, you know, basically having his personal tirade against another politician and take it out on thousands and thousands of people who have nothing to do with that. I mean, that really takes it to a different place.
I think Springsteen summed it up in saying, I had to take a leak, you know. I mean, I think, you know, the inconvenience of it. I mean, it's in the best of times, commuting is a horror show. But when they deliberately jam up the traffic as this was done this time, I mean, it's a...
Well, the story came out as well that... there's the money that he used from the Sandy money to basically do political commercials for himself. But also there was the mayor of Jersey City who said, well, you know, I am not going to support you in the election. All these meetings that were planned with Christie to lay out budgets and things like that, right after the guy says no, all those meetings were canceled. And Christie gave money to other mayors for things that weren't even necessary, and this guy got nothing.
The irony is that, of course, Obama has been nurturing this myth about bipartisanship with, you know, Christie being, you know, the poster boy of it all, you know, that he could get along with with a Republican, and can't we all get along, and this sort of thing. And clearly...
Well, both of them worked that.
Yeah, I mean, but basically it was a false legend, line that was thrown up there. And unfortunately, a lot of people buy it because they are so sick at heart with what's happening in our Congress, the complete paralysis there, and the... You know, the fact that nothing can get done. Finally, a spending bill has been passed, but again, it's filled with the pure pork, as they call it. Totally politicized.
But you know, another thing about the media that really is doing everybody an injustice, and I think a big reason why none of this stuff about Christie comes out is you get people on the left like Bill Maher, and every time a mention is made of Christie, there's a joke about his weight. Every single time, Bill Maher and sometimes Jon Stewart, Colbert, and what it does is this is the standard tag for Chris Christie. And
I was saying before. It distracts away,
and it takes up the space in people's minds that could be used for actual information.
You replace the idea that the man has an agenda and has interests, and that he's tied to interests. You personalize it in terms of him being this character in a way, you know, in the drama, of politics.
And that's the tag, like, you know, the real thing. You know, no, Christie, it's the fat guy and not the criminal.
So, I mean, this is part of, you know, the reality of what we're dealing with is that appearances are very deceptive. And, you know, this issue around the NSA that earlier, Paul Craig Roberts, the former assistant treasury secretary and who's, you know, a very brilliant writer and analyst who told us a little bit about his very impressive biography, which included working in business. As I was sipping some water, he was talking about running a water company. Nevertheless, what he was sort of getting at was a systemic critique of the kind that we really get. And, you know, his take on the whole NSA spying scandal is full stop. It's unconstitutional, period. I don't want to even discuss it in any other terms. But the problem is you have a right wing in this country that uses the Constitution as a battering ram to attack anything they don't like, which they call unconstitutional. So, you know, that whole argument tends to lose support somehow.
Yeah, but it's never applied to the NSA.
And so what happens tomorrow is that after all of this scandal, all of these revelations, day after day, week after week, Edward Snowden emerging as a whistleblower who the whole world seemed to respect, and, you know, was being considered for a Time Man of the Year until, you know, they gave it to the Pope, but, you know, nevertheless admired for his courage and willingness to talk about all of this, and other NSA whistleblowers, defectors, becoming public. Now Obama raises this promise of some sort of a reform. He is going to speak to this issue. And now here's the New York Times today. Obama's path from critic to overseer of spying. Views, it says here, are shaped by plot warnings, which is something that Paul Craig Roberts dismissed, saying that these plots are if not invented, are not worth the overreaction at the occasion.
We remember the red alerts and the orange alerts every time there was a nasty headline article about Bush. We would get an orange warning about.
So the question is, what will the president say? And already, what he is saying, you know, is that he's not going to bring about any major change, because perhaps he can, because he's in the grips of this surveillance state as well, and who knows what they have on him. I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a personal concern there about taking on, you know, the clappers of the world and the Alexanders of the world who control this incredible surveillance machine, which is what it is. And it's not just it's a machine that not only costs a lot of money, but makes a lot of money in a sense.
Well, yeah. And the point I was trying to make earlier was that, like, J. Edgar Hoover did everything he could when he was running the FBI just to get stuff on anybody. And I think that's the instinct of people in power. Going way, way back, you know, if you can do it, find out as much as you can, because it comes in handy when you need it. And I was agreeing with
Paul Craig Roberts.
With Paul Roberts about the fact that this isn't about terrorism. They want to do it because it becomes useful politically. And to keep up the current economic structure as it is.
But, you know, there's an old phrase in certainly political science and what have you, which is capture. You know, that the people in power are captured. The hunter is captured by the game. That their options, their ability to deviate from the course of action that they undertook is limiting to them. I mean, I was just on a program with Reverend Jesse Jackson on Sunday with somebody from the Lyndon Johnson Museum. They were talking about Lyndon Johnson's commitment to the war on poverty and how that's been forgotten about him. Yeah, well, there was another thing going on at the time called the Vietnam War, which he escalated. And, you know, we went through this guns versus butter debate, and guns won, essentially, and the war on poverty trickled down. And, you know, today poverty is very close to what it was all those years ago. So, you know, we have politicians in power. We think they're in power, that they have a lot of power in them to make change, and most of them don't. They're under pressure from so many different interest groups, lobbying groups, their political advisors, and all the rest of it, to be as, shall we say, extremely, you know, kind of timid in their approach.
And also, just going back to the media again, which is the way people find out what's going on in the world. You know, when it comes down to it, war is just a lot much better television than helping the poor. And that's what's going to get
And we see this
up on those screens.
And, of course, we see this through a filter of American amnesia. You know, so like all of a sudden the Al-Qaeda is back, although it's not clear that these people are Al-Qaeda, but they may be affiliated with. But they're local Iraqi forces who remember very well what happened in Fallujah the first time around, the slaughter of people there, the massacre of people there, the use of white phosphorus and napalm and all kinds of ways that took a tremendous toll on the civilian population. The people who are fighting now don't forget these things, even
well,
if Americans don't forget them and don't want to remember them, if you will.
Or don't know about them.
And, you know, here we have in Afghanistan, okay, President Karzai, okay, he was like, you know, kind of a tool. He lived in Cleveland somewhere. He was in the haberdashery industry. He designed a beautiful costume for himself. And, you know, he cannot justify the continuing civilian deaths that are being caused by drones and bombing in Afghanistan. He's challenging it, and the United States is pushing him to sign an agreement that will allow the United States to remain there after years of saying, oh, it's going to be over, 2014, we're pulling out. We're not pulling out.
Well, of course.
And so you say, of course, but what do you think the public thinks about all this? What do they know about the actual, what's happening to people there? It's really dramatic.
And I think the public, you know, the way the public, it took a while to get on to George W. Bush. And I think they're getting on to what's going on in Afghanistan. There's hardly any public support for staying there.
Well, now there's this big movie out, you know, about Afghanistan with Mark Wahlberg, you know, about,
yeah,
you know, kind of our heroes, you know, fighting the heathens and fighting, you know, the Taliban and all the rest of it. And, of course, what people don't realize is the Taliban came to power because they stopped massacres that were taking place in Afghanistan. Nobody knows who they are, what they are. They say, you say Taliban, other people say, well, 9/11. They did it, but they didn't do it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you can go into the local terrorist gift shop and buy an Al-Qaeda T-shirt, you know, and you, as far as the CIA goes, this is an Al-Qaeda guy. And, I mean, it seems to be that easy to become aligned with Al-Qaeda. And like you say, there's no way to know. And the whole idea of labeling these people as terrorists does everybody a disservice, because they're not terrorists. That's the form that people without a nation take on for their armed services.
Well, which brings me, of course, to the issue that I've been writing about and talking about, which is Nelson Mandela's contribution. Don't forget, he was labeled a terrorist,
sure,
by the apartheid regime in South Africa. Moreover, the United States government put him on the terror list, and it was only in 2008, 18 years after he was released from prison, that he was taken off that list. So for all those years, officially, he was designated as a terrorist by the U.S. government. And of course, his story you know, which is quite unprecedented in many cases in history, of somebody who was a prisoner, who was an opposition leader, who was a military commander-in-chief of an organization called the Spear of the Nation that was challenging apartheid, that Nelson Mandela, a movie about him, is getting zero attention. It was not on any of the awards, you know, certainly that the Oscars announced today at all. I mean, there's a song by Bono, which was completely a political love song, was chosen,
right,
and is the end song that he contributed to the, you know, movie. Actually, Bono himself was the guy that wrote the most political song as part of the Sun City project called Silver and Gold, talking about the mineral wealth of South Africa and what was really happening there. He did that at the same time the cultural boycott was really being aimed at a gambling resort in South Africa, the Sun City Resort. Bono was raising this a whole deeper question. But now, in this movie, it's a, you know, kind of a U2-ish love song, which was nominated and won the Golden Globes and may yet win an Oscar, because I think there's some feeling of remorse, if you will, that there wasn't any award for the Mandela movie. But, I think it has to do with Americans prefer narratives of victimization and subjugation to narratives of liberation and victory for people, and a more political approach to movie making. So, you know, American Hustle, of course, and even 12 Years a Slave was really not about slavery. It was about a slave,
right,
who is freed by, you know, a white man, not by a people's revolt.
Yeah, but there was also the movie about Lincoln that was all based on signing the emancipation. Yeah, and I think the bigger issue is that Americans, you know, are interested in struggles for freedom, but not struggles for freedom in other countries. We're not very interested in the rest of the world. Well, it's simply here for our amusement.
Except we're also not very aware of the role our own government and corporations played in supporting systems of oppression around the world, including in South Africa. We had on the program the other day a young man, a student at MIT, who's seeking out information about the role the CIA played in Mandela's arrest, and he wants the CIA. He's trying to get documents under the Freedom of Information Act. So far, he's been stymied. And just 2 days ago, I got an email from a journalist in South Africa who wrote to me and said, "What do you think of this guy? What is your take on it?" And I said, "Well, look, in my book, which is, you know, Madiba A to Z, I write about the information that the CIA was involved, and that's in my book, but it was not in the news and the obituaries for Mandela. It was sort of vacuumed out of history, sanitized out of history, even though the story had been covered in the Associated Press and the New York Times. There's no institutional memory. People, journalists, don't even read what, you know, they used to read what was called the morgue, the clips, what the paper had covered before. Now they don't even do that. So there's no historical context.
Well, how long did it take for word to really filter into the mainstream about the CIA's involvement with Allende? It took, what, 20 years? I mean, you know, who didn't know about it?
So, I mean, so that's what we're dealing with. And so that's why when we talk about the NSA, or we talk about Mandela, or we talk about, you know, the issues that Paul Craig Roberts was raising, it's not just about the press. It's not just about politicians. It's not just about who's running the show. It's about us.
It's
about our ability to understand what's happening in our world and our ability to speak out about it in a way that makes some sense, so that we're reasonably informed about what's going on in our name. And this is one of the problems. One of the nice things about the Oscars is that two documentaries have been selected. One of them is about the drone campaign, President Obama's drones, and Jeremy Scahill and Rick Rowley's film has been nominated for an Oscar, and also the film about the killing of so-called communists in Indonesia, which was actually not in the U.S. role, and it wasn't in the film, but what they did do was get people who were actually committed these crimes to reenact them for
right,
the camera
right, yeah.
in this documentary, and that's been chosen as one of the nominated films in the documentary. So it's not all bad news. Tomorrow I'm heading out to Salt Lake City, Utah. I have a book event on Sunday night at Dolly's bookstore in Park City, which is where the Sundance Film Festival is taking place. On Saturday I'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Salt Lake City talking about my book and trying to make it more relevant to Americans in a way that I think it needs to be to have an impact. And we're getting very good feedback on the book, which is nice. The publisher told me it was their best-selling book for the year. So that's a good, you know, good word. I mean, unfortunately, I don't own it, so I'm not going to profit. But, I was paid to write it, and I am proud of the book. So it's something that you can check out at Amazon. You can check out our website, MadibaBook.com, for more information about it. You can write to me and to us at Dissector at mediachannel.org. Feedback on the show. The podcast of this program will be in the archive of PRN FM, and it'll also be on my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow. So thank you all for listening. I'm glad you're back.
And you can listen to and download for free a lot of the Polarity One songs that you hear on this very station at polarityone.com.
There you go.
When I call to love my girl, her folks are always